Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. Well, tonight's show will focus on the life of Dr. Arthur Makuna Jr. and his hot-off-the-press book, Zulu Chess Cutter, From the Slums of Soweto to Success in America. Now, this is a different type of show tonight. Most of my guests have shared stories and strategies on how they have either found their ancestors or how you can find your ancestors. And tonight's guest, Dr. Makuna, is sharing information on life in his ancestral home, a story that we may all want to eventually write about our beginnings. Dr. Arthur Makuna Jr. was born in Soweto, South Africa in 1963, the year the urban settlement was officially named Soweto, which is an abbreviation for Southwest Townships. He participated in the Soweto Uprising of 1976 and was present for the massacre at the University of Zululand in 1983. The latter of these tragedies prompted Dr. Makuna to emigrate to the United States to further his education and pursue a career in medicine. Dr. Makuna currently serves as assistant professor of surgery and director of cardiothoracic surgery at the Howard University College of Medicine. Let me give a warm welcome to Dr. Makuna to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Dr. Makuna, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I know that this has to be an exciting time to finally see that book in print. Please share with us what compelled you to write that book.
Thank you. The reason why I decided to write this story is when I came to this country, I spent some time in New Orleans, where I actually met my wife, Anissa, and we were blessed with a beautiful daughter named Brittany. When Brittany turned 7, she and I had a discussion, and she was asking me about some questions related to where I came from, because she has not been to South Africa yet. And there were times when I would speak to her in Zulu. For instance, I would say some Zulu words, such as the clicks that we use in our native language Zulu, such as Okwaba and Okulu. And so she would look at me with fascination and ask me what that all meant. So I would try to explain to her, and I would try to contrast my life growing up in South Africa with her experience at 7 years old. So I tried to strike a parallel between my seven-year-old experience and her seven-year-old experience. The look of confusion on her face that I could not dispel with the best efforts led me to decide to put some of my experiences growing up in print, because she could not relate to how, for instance, her father, who when he was 7 years old was trying to escape from certain harms brought apart by some of the political reality of how I grew up, sleeping on the tree, for instance, she could not wrap her mind around that. So as a result of that discussion between she and I decided to capture that experience in print so that she could one day be able to pick it up and read it. And so that's how the idea came about.
What a wonderful way to even think of sharing that with your daughter. I can imagine a 7-year-old trying to understand what you were saying. Well, the title of your book is interesting. Why Zulu Chess Cutter?
Well, there's a story behind that. But Zulu, of course, is my native tongue is Zulu, I was going through this journey. I knew at some point several experiences that we will discuss somewhere down the road led to an epiphany that unveiled my destiny to become a heart surgeon. When I was in South Africa, I had no clue that that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but I had no idea that I would end up being a heart surgeon. Mm-hmm. So when I finally completed my journey in this country and I became a physician and had an encounter that led me to my destiny of becoming a heart surgeon, in coming up with the title for the book, I thought, well, you know, it would be great to say the story or the odyssey of a Zulu heart surgeon or the travels of a Zulu heart surgeon, but how more meaningful would it be to use a direct translation of the Zulu word for a surgeon. In Zulu, we use the word ukhlinza, which literally means to slaughter or to cut. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when we, during our ceremonies of propitiating departed spirits, where we would sacrifice livestock for those ceremonies, the word would be ukhlinza, to cut. Mm-hmm. And since I gained access to the heart by going through the breastbone, the chest cutter lent itself very appropriately to that, to define who I am. And therefore, I just correlated my ancestry of Zulu with what I do as a heart surgeon and translated to chest cutter.
Well, isn't that interesting? Well, how would you relate your book? Because when I mentioned in the beginning, we were talking about genealogy. How would you relate your book to genealogy?
Well, when I grew up, my mother and my father separated when I was 2 years old. So I did not really have an opportunity to gain traction into my father's side of my family, even though we lived not too far from each other. We did not have good relations with that aspect of my family. However, I had a grandfather who I met. I remember when I started working, I was 8 years old, started working selling oranges for a gentleman at a train station not too far from where my grandmother's house was situated. And every time I would see my grandfather, who was my father's father, and he loved me. He always took time to come in and chat with me, talk with me. And each time that he addressed me, he always used the salutation, Davizita, which means Your Majesty.
Mm-hmm.
And that sparked an interest in my mind that why would he call me that? So I would ask him several times, and he would take the time to explain to me that I have a direct link to royalty. And when I got older, I actually went back and revisited that history and correlated what he had told me with documented printed material, and I was able to confirm it. Our history goes back to the time of the great Shaka's father, who, Senzanga Kona. As your listeners may know, Shaka was an illegitimate a young man who was born out of wedlock to Senzang Akona and the beautiful Nandi. Nandi, who was the queen, actually named Brittany. Her middle name is Nandi, named after that beautiful queen. Mm-hmm. So when I went back to read that history, our tribe is there's a clan of the Makunus. Now, our name appears either as the M-C-H-U-N-U, or it appears as it, in its current iteration in the book that I have as M-C-U-N-U. Mm-hmm. So if you encounter someone in by the name of Makunu in South Africa, we are all related because we come from the same clan.
Mm-hmm.
And our clan goes back historically to that time. So we come from a very, very proud and a very fierce group of warriors who actually gave Senzang Akona or Shaga's father a fit during that time. I remember Sir William Colenso, one of the British emissaries who came to South Africa, and they met my tribe, and his description of our tribe was that we were prone to violence,
mm-hmm.
Because he could not get his way with the with my clan. So that's how this my history relates to the excellent work that you do on advancing genealogy.
Well, you know, given what you know about your heritage or your lineage, did your lineage make a difference for you in your life?
Yes, it did. Even though part of my when I was growing up, there was always this part of me that lamented the lack of relationship that I had with my father, because I felt that there was a big part of my life missing. However, just knowing that in spite of the fact that he was not a part of my life, that my grandfather had validated the significance of my genetic origin. So that always gave me comfort, and it gave me an excuse to hold my head up, to know that in spite of the definition that I enjoy or lack of definition that I enjoy because of my lack of relationship with my father, that did not define who I am. Who I am is where I descended from. And
mm-hmm.
so even when I had nothing, even when I had nothing but hope, I always knew that I was Ndabezitha. I knew that I was Your Majesty. I knew that I was descended from Your Majesty. And so when I came back and, you know, spring forward a few years now that I have a son myself who, when we were in West Virginia, as we were going through some of our experiences, as I was after I finished training and I started working for the first time as an attending, actually performing open heart surgery, that's where my life led me to West Virginia, no less. And we had difficult experience, which was racially motivated, particularly directed against him, Arthur, that is my son.
Mm-hmm.
And that this knowledge that we are descended from royalty allowed me to be able to put my arms around him and encourage him, that in spite of the epithets that he was receiving in the streets and school and people who were leveling incendiary remarks against him, this is who he is. They cannot define him. They cannot label him. And I suspect in part that helped him to overcome some of that. And I would not have been able to weather, I suppose, the storm had I not had a direct understanding of that that reality of my heritage.
And that sounds like a very strong message to give to your son, that you are a descendant of something much greater, and that don't let, as you said, those others define who you are.
Absolutely.
Which I think is really great. Well, it looks like we have a question coming in, and I'm going to call out the area code of the person who's calling in right now. Area code 850. Do you have a question? Area code 850.
Yes, I do. First of all, I wanted to wish Dr. Makunu much continued success. My name is Thomas Archer, and I attended college with Dr. Mukunu as well as his wife.
Thank you. Hey, thank Thomas, it's good hearing your voice. I just saw you not too long ago on Facebook.
Yes, sir. And listening to your testimony, which I will call it a testimony, is one of the questions I wanted to ask. Do you find it difficult to motivate your own children based on, you know, the experiences that you have and knowing, you know, that your children will never have to come up in a world in which you did? Do you find it hard to motivate them to just be able to tackle, you know, the day-to-day challenges of life?
Yes, I have in the past, because I think that's part of the biggest challenge that we face, because it becomes a two-edged sword. I think in looking at my experiencing and analyzing what I grew up with, there was a big push, and I think it applies to many parents, and I'm sure you can relate to this. It applies to a lot of us who have been through difficulties. We try to ensure that our kids do not have to go through what we went through. And sometimes you wonder if that deprives them of an experience. I frankly would not want my kids to go through what they went through, although it painfully my son did have to end up going through some of the similar experiences that I had experienced in South Africa. But I do find it challenging to motivate them because they see my success. And I'm always reminded of Bill Cosby's character, Bill Cosby on one of his show where he told one of his kids on TV that your mother and I are rich. You are not rich. You have to earn your riches. So that becomes the challenge. But, you know, I think just reminding them of this and sharing this with them. And that's one of the reasons why I was so eager for the book to come out, because now they can read about it and put it away maybe, and then they can come back and pick it up again and say, wait a minute, this is what my daddy went through? And then, of course, other people, as they pick it up, they can look at this and say, wow, okay, now I can have a different appreciation. It's a challenge to try to motivate our kids currently, I think, with everything that they're now exposed to. But on the other hand, it presents an opportunity for us as well, because it gives us an opportunity to be creative. I've learned some more creative ways to get my kids to do things. And I will honestly tell you that sometimes I have to intersperse some threats in there and some sanctions, but nevertheless, I would not trade that job for anything in the world.
All right, thank you. Much continued success to you.
Hey,
right.
Thanks a lot, man. Good talking
to you.
Thank you.
Well, you mentioned what you grew up with. Why don't you take us back to South Africa and help us understand what life was like under apartheid and the impact it had on you and your family?
Okay. Well, the most important thing as a point of departure to answer your question is to also define what apartheid means. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word. Afrikaans is a language that was only spoken in South Africa and some parts of Nairobi. And this is a derivation of English, Dutch, German, and again, as I said, it was exclusively spoken in South Africa. Uh-huh. And what apartheid literally means is separateness. Uh-huh. So the whole system of apartheid was designed to keep South Africans separated on the basis of their races. And given the fact that we, the native South Africans or black South Africans were the majority in terms of number, this system was orchestrated in such a very systematic way over a period of time and it became so brutal with the single focus of keeping native South Africans segregated from each other so that the ruling national party could be able to control their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So the laws that were therefore created to support this system were designed to promote this separation.
Mm-hmm.
So as a consequence, for instance, to give an example, my native language is Zulu, as I indicated, even though I grew up in South Africa. The National Party, which were the authors of the apartheid system, designated Zululand as the homeland for every Zulu-speaking native, regardless of whether he had been born there or not. But the way they did it, though, is that this land, which accounted for only, we, in other words, Africans were given only less than 13% of the land, even though they made up almost 97% of the population of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that land that was given to us was land that was not fit to grow anything. I could not grow anything. It was just dry, arid land that was designed solely to keep us in those locations away from the main urban sites.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal, frankly, was to ensure a steady stream of servants to commute to the cities so that they could work, be given permission to work within the cities for a duration of 2 weeks or so, and then be allowed to go back home. And so that law, which was known as the Group Areas Act, permeated every aspect of my life when I was growing up in South Africa. We were not allowed to go downtown. We were not allowed to go to town without permission. As a consequence, I really had never met a white person until 1976, when I was almost 12 years old. And I write in the book about how that meeting was punctuated by the barrel of a gun that was pointed at me. That was my first encounter with a white person. Prior to that, my only encounter had been by reading books and papers and newspapers. That's where I'd seen pictures of white persons, which was truly an experience that most of us faced. The biggest part of apartheid for me was educationally. We had an educational system which was referred to as Bantu education. Now, Bantu means people, literally in Zulu, and also another translation for Bantu is communality, the sense of communing with different people around yourself. But the Afrikaners used Bantu pejoratively to negate our identity as a people. So they collectively regarded us as Bantu so that they would not have to acknowledge us as Zulu individuals, Sotho, or as Nelson Mandela's tribe, Xhosa, and so on. So we became this generic collective Bantu, so that the educational focus for us then became Bantu education, whose design was not to give us any leverage as far as being able to choose jobs is concerned. What I mean by that is that when the educational system was introduced in 1958, the exact words that were uttered by one of the authors of the Bantu education system was, and I quote, "Black people should be taught enough to understand and carry out the instructions of their white masters," and I close the quote.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the design of Bantu education. And so this is the education that I was exposed to. This is the system that I was exposed to. But a side and serendipitous benefit to that exposure, however, was that, number one, it sparked an interest in those of us who had something that was burning to know more, to learn more. I was inspired by my mother, who was a reader, even though she had not had means to advance her educational efforts. Yet she recognized within me early on, even when I was 4 years old, I was reading, she recognized that and did everything she could to try to spur that on.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of that, I developed a hunger that I just refused to dim in spite of everything else that was leveled at me to gain education. We also had some exposure to the British educational system, which was introduced to us through missionaries and through some other religious organizations. However, again, the National Party did everything they could to try to undermine those efforts and to try to destroy them so that we could just learn how to understand and carry out instructions, because our station in life was supposed to be long-term and lifelong indentured servants. And there was no role for educating indentured servants. And so that really was the basis for the educational system that we had. So that explains why, that I had to literally run from one place to the next just to try to get an education.
It sounds like you really went through some extremely challenging times in your childhood.
Yeah, it built character. And you know, in retrospect, I learned that those experiences, they were just setting me up to become the person that I am today.
Well, let me just see if we have any questions. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. We don't have any questions, but right now we're going to take a quick break and come back in a minute. Just a quick break, okay?
Okay. All right.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Dr. Arthur Makuna as he shares his journey from Soweto to success in America. I just want to go back to what you were talking about as a young student. I know I read your book, and it does seem as if a lot of your friends did not make it. What set you apart from them?
I can start with my mother. Just to go back a couple of steps, you know, in 1976, we had a monumental time in South Africa where the National Party, consistent with their goals to try to limit how much education we received, and number one, and number two, also to limit our ability to leave South Africa, because again, as indicated, the goal was to keep us there to serve. They wanted to now impose Afrikaans as the medium of instruction in schools for blacks. We were going to be the only ones who had no choice of what language to use for the education. Everybody else who resided in South Africa, which included Indians and a race that is indigenous to South Africa known as Coloureds, which was a mixture of native Africans and whites, and then, of course, the white race. So those were the four original races in South Africa, and those were strictly segregated. The Afrikaans as a foreign language, as a language, therefore, as a medium of instruction, created such widespread dissatisfaction among not only the educators but also the students as well. And so in 1976, on June 6th, when I had turned 12, we met along the Orlando West as a group of students to try to protest that rule, and we were met by the South African Security Defense Force at gunpoint. I mean, they were readily armed, and they were willing and ready to use their arms. After a short period of time, they opened fire. It was live fire. And that's when really some of the problems with losing some of my friends and some of my schoolmates started. I recall trying to escape and scramble away from that onslaught, watching some of my classmates being mowed down by live bullets falling down around me, and just it was all I could do just to avoid being stampeded as I scrambled to try to find my way back home. Subsequent to that, we the South African security forces started going in and out of houses on the subsequent days, invading houses and taking away, mostly it was young men of my age, school age, and a lot of those kids were never accounted for, and they would disappear. And sometimes they would, if there were two of us playing outside, and an unmarked car would drive by and just out of the windows open fire indiscriminately. I lost one of my best friends around that same time. It was after the riot. We were playing under those setting. He and I were playing marbles, and we heard this gunshot ringing, and we scrambled and lay down as we had become used to doing around that time. And there was usually was always a second round of gunshots. I never forget that. It was almost like you laid flat until you heard the second round of gunshots, and then you could then get up and go along with your daily activities. And when you hear another round, you slump down again and wait for the second. So it was then that I noticed that my friend was not moving. My best friend was not moving. And I actually went over to him, and when I turned him over, he had sustained a gunshot wound right to the middle of his chest. Now, you know, at that time, you know, I put my fingers on to try to stem the blood flow, but he was already dead. It's ironic that he bled from a wound that would later be one that I spend my life now treating as a part of my career. I just thought about that, that correlation. But a lot of young people disappeared following those riots, and a lot of young people were killed indiscriminately by that. The other problem that we faced in South Africa is because of the educational system was as it related to the housing. Mm-hmm. My book is titled From the Slums of Soweto to Success. Literally, we do have the housing in South Africa. We had unofficial housing that cropped up in the backyards of many homes where people would erect shanties and slums to try to accommodate either relatives or to use them as forms of business to try to attract some revenue because the government had done very little to ensure proper housing for the vast majority of blacks that had been disposed or had been moved from the outskirts of the cities, such as Johannesburg and so on. Mm-hmm. So as a consequence of that, if you mix that crowded living and you mix that with the fact that education was limited for Soweto residents, we experienced a widespread epidemic of HIV disease, for instance. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember recently that South Africa led the world in terms of the number of people that were infected with AIDS, HIV disease. And when I went back to South Africa, I found, much to my heartbreak, that a lot of people that I had grown up, a lot of young people that I had grown up, had succumbed to this entity as well. So in addition to the ravages of apartheid and the willful assault of some of my friends, when I came back, I realized that I had lost some of them, a significant number of them also, to the ravages of AIDS, which I believe is a corollary to some of the problems that we face with apartheid.
And it sounds like just something very painful to remember.
Yes.
And to put in writing and to share, but it is a part of your life.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So what led you to the United States?
Well, when I, after the 1976 riots, schools were closed for a couple of years. Just growing up as young boys, we started getting in trouble. And again, my mother never gave up on that notion that I had to get an education. She never gave up on giving me and my sisters, I have two sisters who are twins, she never gave up on that desire to at least give us the opportunity to acquire higher education so that we can be able to fend for ourselves. She ended up talking to a friend of hers with whom she had shared a room in one of the hostels in South Africa, outside of Soweto, who allowed my sisters and I to go and stay with her mother in Colenso, which is located in Natal. Colenso offered us a separate brand of challenges, some of which were of a spiritual nature. But nevertheless, I was able to finish a year there then prepare myself for high school. Mm-hmm. So when I came back in back to Soweto in 1979, I finished 4 years of high schooling. And, South Africa had standardized exams, which was separate for blacks compared to the other races. And there was a very strict quota that was followed that would allow certain blacks to graduate from high school to go to college. For instance, in my class, we had 92 people that set for those final exams as in our 12th grade, which was standard 10 in South Africa, and only four of us passed. So 88 students who had spent their lives trying to go through into high school never made it, didn't qualify to go to college. Even I, though I passed, I did not have the requisite grades that would have allowed me to go directly into medical school. So I ended up at Zululand University to take what they called O-levels. And O-levels were some remedial classes that would ensure that I had the requisite coursework to then go into medical school. Mm-hmm. And that year was very difficult for me because we were faced with multiple boycotts at school. New Zealand University sits in the middle of the homeland of Zululand, whose chief was Chief Buthelezi, even though he had never declared, for instance, for independence. He ran New Zealand as an independent homeland. Mm-hmm. There were 10 homelands identified as such. And again, back to what we talked about before, the goal was to segregate blacks not only on the in terms of their origin, but also in terms of their native languages. So there were 10 native homelands, Zululand being one of them. Mm-hmm. Coming from Soweto, and Zululand had almost 70% population came from Soweto or from outside of Zululand. We were very militant. We were constantly striving to fight against the prevailing political system. Mm-hmm. The opposite of that is that the apartheid insinuated itself in every aspect of our campus lives. We were presented with horrible food in the cafeteria. Sometimes we had meatloaf that was green, fungus-tinged, and every time we would get up to try to boycott, the president would instruct us, listen, I don't speak to a mob, get a delegation to come and talk to me. So we'd get a delegation, and then, of course, he promptly fired the delegation, so we would boycott. Long story short is that we ended up doing this back and forth until towards October, which was a very pivotal time for us because Chief Buthelezi identified October 29th, 1983, as a time when he was going to actually bring his organization, the Inkatha Freedom Movement, to commemorate one of our previous celebrated Zulu kings. The students rebelled against it. We rebelled against that because, number one, we realized that his intention was not to come in peace. He was coming for a reckoning. He had an established history of that. So we boycotted and we begged the administration to prevent what we knew was going to be a certain clash. However, we did not receive a favorable response. So, not surprisingly, in October, when he came on campus, he came and executed what he had planned to do, to attack the students, some of whom he attacked while they were sleeping. So we had a massacre on campus on October 1983, where if you went through the dorms, I remember that vividly as if it was yesterday. I was able to escape without any of my belongings, but some students were not able, were not as fortunate. Some of them were attacked while they were sleeping, and some died while they were asleep. There was blood everywhere on campus, on the walls, in the dormitories. And I've seen the movie The Shining. I always think of the blood gushing down the corridors.
Yeah.
It always reminds me of that scene. Mm-hmm. In those dormitories. These were people that had come to try to advance their education, and this is where they were now. Nevertheless, after that massacre, I came back the following year, and we had the same political problems and same back and forth with same organization. And it became clear that I needed to either find something else to do or I had to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Serendipitously, I had a girlfriend at the time who had contact, who had friends who had been to the United States, and that's how I was able to get contact with the Perkins, who are based in New York, who, after communicating with them, they were willing to allow me to come and stay with them while they helped me to find somewhere to go to advance my education. And so when I finally did secure a ticket and I stayed with the Perkins for a while in New York, they helped me to enroll at historically black colleges, including Xavier, Howard, and Morehouse. And it was not until the second week of September that I was finally granted the privilege of being in college. When I was ready to go back to South Africa, defeated and wondering if anything was ever going to happen with my life, that was positive. I received a call when I least expected it to come to Xavier, and when that door was opened, I never looked back. I hit the ground running, and that's how I was able to get started with my education in America.
Well, was it at Xavier University that you decided to become a physician?
No, I had already my decision to become a physician stemmed from some of my experiences back in South Africa. You know, when I held my best friend who died in my arms,
yes.
And also when I lost my cousin who died mysteriously. He and I were very close, so I knew I wanted to be a doctor, some kind of doctor. I just did not have some of an idea what kind of doctor I was going to be. So
mm-hmm.
after I finished Xavier, actually, I ended up at Howard University College of Medicine, where my initial attraction was to become a brain surgeon. And I have to admit to you and to your listeners that decision was fueled by pride. I thought, hey, you know, I can become the biggest and baddest surgeon is a brain surgeon. At least that's what I thought. At the time.
Okay.
So that was pride. So pride directed me towards that specialty.
Mm-hmm.
But when I actually explored and spent some time with a neurosurgeon who took me under his wings and guided my efforts to get into that field, I realized one thing. That was not who I was meant to be. There was no connection. There was nothing connecting me to that field of work. It was another tragedy that unveiled my destiny to become a heart surgeon. I was serving now as a general surgery resident at Howard. I was a second year resident then, I was on call. This is during the height of gun-related and gang war in D.C. A lot of gun-related deaths. And I had been on call and had seen almost 20 or so young people who had come in with multiple gunshot wounds that had prompted them to go to the operating room. It was around 2 o'clock. I'll never forget this. A gentleman who had been shot multiple times was dropped off into the emergency room, just like we see sometimes in the movies where somebody drops somebody off in the emergency room on the floor and then they speed off. This is exactly what happened with this gentleman. And he was brought in. And so they immediately picked him up and put him on a stretcher and called the trauma team, of which I was a member. And as I came downstairs, there was a gentleman who was my chief resident on call that day. And he decided that was a good opportunity for me to learn to perform a procedure that we call open heart massage. This allows us to be able to do a thoracotomy, in other words, expose the heart where it lives in its sac, and try to perform resuscitation and fix any injuries that you identify on the heart. And so I remember them screaming at me as I'm sitting there readying myself to perform this procedure. I had studied for it. My hands were steady. I did not feel intimidated at all, so I was able to just tune them out. And I performed the procedure. Now, let me tell you, Bernice, when I held that heart, the heart was beat up. It was multiple gunshot wounds. There was nothing I could do for it. But as soon as I held that heart in my hand, I experienced a feeling like no other. I experienced almost like a kinship. It was almost like a primal recognition that I felt that ripped right through me. And in recognition that this is what I was meant to do. It was almost like it was a direct light. I don't know how to describe it. The point is that it was such a feeling that I have never, cannot think of anything that I can take superficially that can duplicate that experience.
Mm-hmm,
and that's how I knew. I knew at that point that I was going to pursue heart surgery. And so when I did apply for heart surgery, almost like an affirmation, I received almost 130 offers for an interview. And
Wonderful.
Yeah. So it was just, it was almost like an affirmation that this is what you're meant to do.
This is what you were meant to do. Absolutely. Well, let me just see. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. We do have a question coming out of the chat. I think you addressed this, but someone would like you to once again just say a little about the history of the Zulu people and how they were taught in the public school system, and is it the same today?
That's a great question. So just going back to the Zulu people, a lot of, just to tie in some of the genealogy that I mentioned with regard to my royalty lineage, most of what we were taught was passed on by word of mouth. So there was when Zulus have, for instance, when somebody greets me with my last name, they then greet me and use a specific characters of my my lineage. Mm-hmm. For instance, they would say my Kunwane, which is one of our Zulu kings, one of our clan kings, Pagade, Simagade, and those are names of our ancestors and kings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one aspect of that lesson that was that tradition has held. The other aspect of it, which was very humbling for me, was when I finally had an opportunity to meet and talk with my father when I was 40 years old. I had an opportunity to finally meet and talk with him because my grandfather had told me that he had kept our history in print.
Mm-hmm.
And I did actually get to see it, and I was very, very, very moved by how meticulous the record-keeping had been by my grandfather that he had given to my father. I'm still trying to get a copy of that. However, so the schools originally, to answer your, the viewer's question, listener's question, I'm sorry, the schools originally were segregated, completely segregated, in the sense that we received a brand of instruction that was driven by the motivation of our teachers. those who cared to teach, those who wanted us to see us succeed, those who took their extra time to make sure that they stayed after school, for instance, because we did not have resources to buy books. The teachers would keep us after school so that we could be able to share books to do our homework. So they did that voluntarily. The schools are different now in South Africa. Since 1994, since we had our first national elections or non-racial elections, since when Nelson Mandela was released, the schools are now mixed. You have a group of students who are Afrikaners or white with British heritage. Indian students, colored students, and black students who are now who go to the same schools.
Okay.
And the same is true for the universities. And we actually have it's a huge deficit that was left by Bantu education because a significant disparity still exists educationally because many blacks were not prepared for their transition. They had never received some of that education. So functionally, they're challenged because they cannot fill some of the roles that have been produced by industrialization, which could best be supported by some of the education that many of them had never received. And so it's therefore you find when you go back to South Africa, much to my heartbreak, sometimes you hear some people who are lamenting some of the older days.
Yes.
Because there is a significant degree of corruption in South Africa, where a small percentage of individuals still controls a significant part of the resources. And so we have a significant number of people who feel that they struggled, they fought for nothing.
And that no change has taken place.
And no change has taken place, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another question coming out of the chat, and they want to know, are you in touch with loved ones at home? And
yes.
If so, how are they making it?
Well, my mother still lives in South Africa, and as do my sisters. I have two sisters. So that's my small family. And then, of course, I have relatives. So I keep up with my mother. Actually, I talked to my mother about 3 days ago. I called. I used it as a resource, particularly as I was for some of the information to fill out the gaps because I was very concerned about making sure that this work was very authentic. And that it reflected very accurately what I wanted it to reflect. When I first came here, just to respond to and to that is that when I first came here, I literally, Bernice, when I had an opportunity to finally go to school, I literally closed off all of my experiences in South Africa so that I could focus on finally achieving this entity that I had been chasing, which was education.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I actually wrote this book, and one of the reasons why it took me a little while is because I experienced some of these, I had to relive some of these experiences, and some of them were very traumatic, and some of them I would have to put the book down, just so I could be able to go back, relive them, and then use them as a cathartic, and to purge myself, and so I can be able to move on to the next step. So
yeah.
It has been a mixed but overall, a great journey to do that. And my family has been a very intimate part of that. And my mother continues to do well, and she lives within Soweto. She's part of the folks that are still concerned about the fact that, they went through all these things, and yet when they look around, they're seeing nothing but worse circumstances, as do my sisters. And so I have a sister who has, one of my sisters who is a twin, has experience with computer programming, but she cannot find a good job in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's become almost like who do you know type of deal.
Right. So the opportunities are just not there as they expected them to be.
No, they're not. And it's very heartbreaking, yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you want people to take away after reading your book?
They are several things. The most important thing is that one should not be deterred by where you begin. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very difficult to really see the forest because of the trees if you're too close to them. And part of my frustration when I was pursuing an education in South Africa and some of the bitterness that I was starting to accumulate because I was being thwarted at every direction was because I felt that I knew that there was something that was driving me that I had to accomplish, but it seemed like I was not going to be able to accomplish. Now, mm-hmm. in retrospect, for instance, during the apartheid time, I would not have become a physician in South Africa to become a surgeon, because legally, under the apartheid laws, blacks were not allowed to become surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
So it was against the law to be a surgeon, and yet here I am, a surgeon, and it was almost a spiritual experience, an odyssey that took me out of that experience, that system, and brought me to where I was finally able to be positioned to be able to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd like to encourage those who listen, those who read the book, is that take home the message that really it does not matter where you start. What matters is where you end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the key. And a lot of times it may seem like that all you're facing is nothing but darkness. But if you persist, if there's something that is inside you that you have a strong desire for, something that compels you, push forward. And before you know it, an opportunity will present itself when you least expect it. And that is my story. That's my life.
Well, that's a wonderful story. There is a question coming out, and the question is, are there plans to take your family to South Africa so that they can truly understand where you came from?
Yes. Yes. We actually are hoping, and I'm planning to take them to South Africa next year. My daughter, Brittany, who started this whole literary journey, decided that she wanted to be so much like her father that she wanted to go to medical school. So she is a second year in medical school and appears to have been bitten by the same bug to do heart surgery as her father has been.
Well, congratulations. I know that probably makes you very proud.
Oh, it's a wonderful feeling. And our youngest, Jordan, who is 11, is now old enough that I believe that he should be able to understand what's going on in South Africa. And, yes, we plan a trip now so that they can be able to go back to South Africa. My beautiful wife has never been to South Africa either, and I want to be able to present her to my beautiful country so she can see where I came from and what informs some of the tenacity that I have.
Well, that is wonderful. Now, how can individuals obtain a copy of your book?
Well, right now, the copies, the best way to obtain a book is to place advance orders. We can do that through my email. And that way they can actually send information, because I'd love to be able to autograph and make it personal and send the copies to them. The email would be zuluchesscutter@yahoo.com. We also do have a website, which is titled zuluchesscutter.com, where people can be able to read some excerpts, look at some of the pictures, and just look at some of the information, author-related information. But the easiest and best way to get the book is going to be to place an order through zuluchesscutter@yahoo.com, and I will send an invoice with the PayPal link.
Okay. And also, are any special book signings scheduled?
I have some coming up. We're going to do a book signing, of course, in D.C. At Howard University Hospital. I mean, Howard University Bookstore. And also we have a book signing the first Saturday of February in New York at Wyandotte Library, which is on Long Island. And I will have that information posted as well on the website so that people can be able to get some more information on that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that people, you will hear from individuals, and I want to thank you so much for this interview tonight. And I also want to just recognize so many of the outstanding genealogists who gave an hour of their time to share their expertise on research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This show was launched in September under the mentorship of Antoinette Harrell of Nurturing Our Roots, Blog Talk Radio and Television. And I certainly want to thank Antoinette for her support. The very first show, however, was kicked off with Melvin J. Collier. Melvin is the author of 150 Years Later, Broken Ties Mended. And I hope that if you have not purchased Melvin's book, that you will do so. This is a book all of you would want to read. Following Melvin, we went on with several other guests, Sharon Morgan of About Us, Our Black Ancestry, Angela Walton Raji from African Roots Podcast, and you can listen to the podcast every Friday. Guest host was Sylvia Lewis, and she interviewed New York Anchor One, Cheryl Wills, the author of Die Free. Of course, we had a wonderful, wonderful explanation of slavery era research with Aaron Dorsey. And Aaron is coming on next week, so I hope that you all will go back and listen to his show and be prepared to ask him those burning questions about slavery era research. Barbara Ricard Landix, I want to thank Barbara for going over the Southern Claims Commission records, and Natan Kemp, who came on twice to talk about how can we find records without the 1890 census, and she also shared with us researching, finding resources in Virginia. How could we do that? We had Harry Jones, who spoke very eloquently about African Americans in the Civil War, and Beverly Babin Woods, who spoke of education during Reconstruction in Lafayette, Louisiana. And I don't want you to forget Michael Henderson. Michael Henderson gave us a wonderful discussion on finding Agnes Mitchew. Blake Bell and Mark Engler were on the show speaking of the 150th anniversary of the Homestead Act of 1862. And just last week we had Tanya Broder, who spoke of resources in Edgefield, South Carolina. I have a great lineup coming for you in 2012, of which I will share with you next week. But I also want to make sure that everyone knows that Alvin Alexander provided the music that starts this show, Sweet Mellow Spice. So thanks to all of you for helping this show become a reality. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Tune in next Thursday, as I said, for a continuation of a discussion on slavery era research with Aaron Dorsey. And if you missed part one, please listen to that show and come with your questions next Thursday. Dr. Makuna, I want to thank you for joining me tonight and sharing your book with us, Lulu Chestcutter, From the Slums of Soweto to Success in America. I know you must be proud, and you have made your mother proud and your ancestors proud.
Thank you.
And I am proud of you. So proud of you.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I had a wonderful time.
Thank you so much. Well, I want to just say, remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you shall follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and Beyond. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night.
Good night.